Lecture 9. Robe Grier, Experimental Fiction and Myth.
The publication of Alain Robe Grier's The Erasers motivated the creation of the term the new novel. On first reading, it is a detective story pushed to the condition of true fantasy. Its radical style, Robe Grier claimed, has important epistemological consequences, and in that way is both a fantastic development of Émile Zola's idea of the experimental novel and the fulfillment of Roland Barthes' prediction about the evolution of writing. On closer examination, the novel also reveals itself as a reworking of the materials of the Oedipus myth, as the structural anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss understood it, and as a critical reexamination of Freudian ideas about psychological fantasy. Indeed, for a clever minority of readers, or rereaders, there is a last fantastic trick that converts this apparently ambiguous detective novel into a stable work of aesthetic didacticism. For most people, on first reading, The Erasers by Robe Grier seems to be a fantastic, compelling, but deeply confusing detective novel. Yet, because of what close reading and rereading reveal, it had a huge critical and indeed popular success, and led to the creation of the term in France, le nouveau roman, the new novel. The Erasers is told primarily from the viewpoint of a detective, Wallace, sent to a provincial town to solve a murder. Many of his observations are less obviously gathering clues about this murder than inquiries into his own sense of reality. What should he make of coincidences? For example, one witness tells that after the murder occurred, she observed someone running down the street, and that someone was wearing an overcoat with a triangular-shaped wound in the cloth. While in the town, Wallace, wearing an overcoat, snags his shoulder on a piece of fence post and winds up having exactly the same clue. But is it a clue, or is it something about Wallace? Can anything significant be read into the pictures that Wallace thinks that he sees in random assemblages of flotsam on the stagnant canal water? For instance, he sees corks and bits of orange peel, and as the wind moves the surface of the dead canal water about, he thinks they form perhaps the image of Punch and Judy, or maybe a map of America, if charitably read. Much of what is reported in the novel, like the behavior of the cafe manager who does things mechanically again and again, or the riddling drunkard, seems entirely irrelevant to solving the crime. Here is a drunkard who comes up repeatedly in the novel. At this point, he's asking a riddle. He stands up on a table in the saloon, a back room of which Wallace is using as his residence and base while in the town investigating. And he says, "Tell me, what animal is a parasite in the morning?" "That's all we need was this goon here," Antoine, the manager, objects. "You don't even know what an oblique line is, I'll bet. You look pretty oblique to me." And so on. And then he continues, "What animal is parasite in the morning, incestuous at noon, and blind at night?" Oh, and he thinks, no, wait a minute. It's blind in the morning, incestuous at noon, parasite at night. Well, what animal is it? No, deaf at noon, blind at night, limps in the morning. I'm just asking a riddle. In fact, this strange book full of strange details has one that threw the original readers way off. In the next to last chapter, Wallace goes to the murder scene and tries to recreate the passage that the murderer must have taken up the stairs to go and kill the victim. While in the victim's study, he hears someone on the stairs. He hides behind the desk, the light flashes on, and he shoots the intruder. and winds up killing the man whose murder he was sent to solve. At the very end of the book, neither we nor the detective knows who truly killed this individual or how to understand reality. The individual who was killed is named Dupont, French for at the bridge. There were two Duponts mentioned in the bridge, in the erasers, Albert and Daniel, A and D Dupont. Maybe this is an A.D. kind of story, after the birth of Jesus. The novel is told in a relentlessly meticulous, flat style that seems almost cinematic. Indeed, much was made of the idea that this book got rid of rhetorical devices and only gave us the facts, ma'am, nothing but the facts. Here's a famous example, famous because it's been written about on numerous occasions. A quarter of a tomato that is quite faultless, cut up by the machine into a perfectly symmetrical fruit. This isn't even a sentence. It is, however, a detailed description of something for sale in a cafeteria. The peripheral flesh, compact, homogeneous, and a splendid chemical red, is of an even thickness between a strip of gleaming skin and the hollow where the yellow graduated seeds appear in a row, kept in place by a thin layer of greenish jelly along a swelling of the heart. And this goes on for twice as much longer as I've just read. These descriptions, I think, are not truly cinematic. We need to understand that the word flesh is a metaphor. The flesh of a vegetable is not flesh. A splendid chemical red reflects someone's attitude, in fact, an ironic attitude toward that color. There is no hollow inside a fruit, tomato slice. It is our view of that curve that makes it be a hollow rather than, say, a bump, viewed for the other way. The seeds are not graduated. That's our idea. They are of different sizes. And there is no swelling toward the heart. Tomatoes have no hearts. In fact, even at its most cinematic, language tends to give us a projection of ourselves. The novel's movements also attempt to become superficial, cinematic, detailed, and somehow get rid of the observer, although, as we can see, that does not truly happen. For instance, the novel, as it moves from one passage to another, mimics the cinematic techniques of tracking, panning, and montage. There's one lovely passage where we see Wallace looking at an eraser. He puts the eraser down on the front left corner of a desk. The next phrase tells us about a sheaf of papers being raised from a desk, and underneath the papers is another eraser. These cinematic techniques make the book feel as if it is not really a novel, but just some strange imaginary report of some investigation. The book has been called experimental. The term experimental goes back to Émile Zola, a great French novelist. In works like Germinal, Zola sought to represent society in a believable way, to set characters and social forces in motion within the novel, and then to see what they would do. In that sense, Zola saw the novel as an experiment. That is, if he could create a world within the novel which had believable characters and believable social forces, and they led to certain outcomes, in a sense he was running an experiment that would convince his readers that those forces in our lives would have these outcomes. Germinal, for example, tells the story of a town where the main industry is a coal mine, and we see the lives of the miners, the owners, and so on. The economic interactions among them lead to death and a communist revolution. In other words, the experimental novel served Zola's purposes both aesthetically and politically. Roland Barthes, a great French literary critic and cultural theorist, in one of his early books, a book called in English Writing Degree Zero, studied the evolution of French narrative prose. His idea of writing degree, in French écriture, is that we understand something that is more general than style and yet more specific than language. Now, he understood language and speech as being the synchronic and diachronic aspects of any given language. Language, long, speech, parole. He borrows this from Ferdinand de Saussure, the great Swiss-born linguist. But we all know that between the stable, synchronic language and the ever-moving diachronic parole, speech, we can see regularities that are more stable than just speech. For instance, we can identify a Hemingway style or a biblical style. What Barthes did was suggest that yet more generally than style, but more flexibly than long, we could have an écriture. We could have a kind of style of styles, what in English we could call a graphelect, the way an idiolect is a person's way of speaking. A graphelect is a way of writing. We could have a graphelect that would identify, for instance, a cultural moment or a literary period, like Romantic or modern or postmodern, as we discussed in talking about Orlando. In fact, I've tried this with my students. I've asked ordinary sophomores, well, none of the sophomores at the University of Michigan are ordinary, but I've asked my students, when they happen to be in the office, to close their eyes. I take a random book off the shelf, I open it to a random page, I cover the running head so they can't see the title, and I ask them to read a random paragraph and tell me when the page was written. For works within the last century, my students almost invariably can date it to within 10 years. To works within the last 200 years, they can almost invariably date it to within the last 20. And works from the Renaissance forward, they almost always get it within 40 years, without ever having seen the work before. It's not that they're responding to the style. They're responding to the écriture, to the graphelect, to what Barthes' translator called writing degree. Now, what Barthes did was study the evolution of French prose from the Renaissance to the present. His present, 1950s, when he wrote this book. And he noticed that in the Renaissance, we have a very ornate kind of style. Lots of metaphor, lots of periphrasis that is going the long way around to say something, that finny tribe instead of fish and so on. And that as we move from the Renaissance forward, the degree of ornamentation and decoration that we find in language, in French fictional prose, gets lower and lower. And what he suggests is what might have been once a very high writing degree will ultimately go to writing degree zero. That was his prediction. Wonder of wonders, without ever acknowledging to the general reading public that Roland Barthes and Robe Grier were friends, out comes The Erasers in 1953, and out comes Writing Degree Zero, and people read passages like the one about the quarter slice of tomato and say, my goodness, there's no rhetorical decoration here. Why, we've reached Writing Degree Zero just the way Roland Barthes said we would. And so we have the new novel, a novel dependent upon surfaces and details that nonetheless is involved with a completely imaginary space. A space where the detective is, in fact, the murderer. And if we read it more deeply, we realize it's not writing degree at zero at all. We still push our own feelings into those descriptions. Now, at about the same time that we have this stylistic development, we also have Claude Lévi-Strauss, one of the great anthropologists of the 20th century, coming up with his ideas about culture. While Roland Barthes predicts, if he is in fact is really predicting, the style that we see in The Erasers, we can turn to Levi Strauss to look at its content. In Structural Anthropology, a very, very important book, he also uses de Saussure's ideas about structural analysis to analyze the Oedipus myth, especially famously in Chapter 11, where he shows that every version of the myth, if we line up its different parts, really coheres into a quadripartite structure where 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, those columns of story elements, have a relationship to each other, and the conjoined 1, 2, and 3, 4 have another relationship to each other, and that set of relationships is in fact a powerful, permanent, synchronic mythic structure that exists in our mind in Western culture. Later, Leach, an anthropologist, shows that that structure is exactly the same structure we find in the story of the fall in the Garden of Eden, a famous essay called Levi Strauss in the Garden of Eden. Now, what we need to understand is that this story of Oedipus is not the story of Oedipus that Freud gives us. Freud gives us a story of Oedipus in which the child is eager to supplant the father, kills the father, and decides to marry the mother. But Sophocles' story is not that at all. Sophocles tells the story, which is worth our remembering so that we can free ourselves from Freud. As Sophocles tells the story, Laius and Jocasta, the king and queen of Thebes, are told by the oracle at Delphi, as Laius is told, that he will have a child who will kill him. When Jocasta bears a child, he has that child taken out to the wilderness and staked to the ground through the foot so that the wild animals will come and kill him. A shepherd comes by, sees this poor staked infant, takes him away, crosses the peninsula to Corinth, where he presents the infant to the king and queen of Corinth, who are childless. We're back in the realm of fairy tales, of course. The king and queen raise Oedipus. Oedipus, which means swollen foot or lame foot, is that way because of the staking, but that's his name. He grows up to be an upright young man, and he goes to the oracle at Delphi and is told he will kill his father and marry his mother, not wanting to hurt the king and queen of Corinth, whom he takes to be his father and mother. He leaves. Along the way, he comes to a bridge. He is crossing the bridge, but someone comes in the other direction and says, "Get out of my way, a man with a retinue, a wealthy man." Oedipus, of course, doesn't yield. He's used to being a prince himself. When they meet, the other man starts an altercation. Oedipus punches him. He falls down, hits his head on a rock, and dies. As the story continues, Oedipus goes and passes by the Sphinx. The Sphinx is a mythical beast which kills people by strangling them. The word Sphinx comes from the Greek sphingere. It's the same root as the word sphincter, having to do with opening and closing sections in the human body. The Sphinx asks of all who pass before it a riddle. If you fail to answer the riddle correctly, you are killed. If you do answer the riddle correctly, or so the story predicts, the Sphinx will allow you to go in and become the monarch of Thebes. The Sphinx's riddle is quite famous. She asks, "What goes on 4 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, and 3 in the evening?" Oedipus answers, "Man." We crawl on fours as infants, we stand up on our own two legs as adults, and we use a cane in our old age. The Sphinx throws herself from a cliff and kills herself, thus opening the road to Thebes. The people greet Oedipus joyfully, and since their king has died, they make him their king. In order to cement the legitimacy of his authority, he marries the king's widow. In order to bring justice into the land, he sends out servants to discover what really happened. Of course, we know what really happened. they come back with the message and tell it first to Jocasta that the person who killed the king, Laius, was now their own king, Oedipus. When Oedipus hears this, he is aghast at what he has done. This is no Freudian child who wants to sleep with his mother. This is an upright man who rejects the idea of sleeping with his mother. He runs in to find her, to share the news with her. He goes in and finds that she has hanged herself. He takes the fibula out of her toga and uses the pin to blind himself. And at the end, he's led away by his daughter. Now, the story of Oedipus, as Aristotle understands it, is a story of what we translate as tragic flaw, as if there were something wrong with Oedipus, a hint that Freud accepts. But Aristotle's word is hamartia. It is a term from archery, and it means a missing of the mark. Oedipus didn't do something wrong. He did the right. But sometimes in this world of ours, doing right still produces wrong. That's the human condition. It's no wonder that this story has attained mythic status. What does it mean to say, as Levi Strauss did, that all of the parts of this story coexist at one time? It means, perhaps more easily understandable for those raised in a Christian nation, what St. Jerome meant when he said of the story of the totality of the life of Jesus, Christ dies for us daily. It doesn't mean that Christ dies and then is resurrected and then dies, forever having to go again and again through a cycle the way Prometheus has his liver plucked out anew every day. It means that at all times that suffering exists, and simultaneously the promise that is the resurrection that matters so much to any believing Christian exists. It's a synchronic reality because it's in the world of myth. In the world of myth, as Levi Strauss showed, it doesn't matter the order in which you tell the story parts. The whole of the story coexists at one time. In The Erasers, we have one time. That one time is the time when you are parricide in the morning. You kill your father first, and then blind at night. Is this myth the only myth that could possibly tell this story? No. Robrier lets us see the difference. The riddle man comes up again, as he's so called, again later in the book. What animal in the morning? He tries to remember, but he can't remember. And then he gives a different riddle. He says, what animal is black, has six legs, and flies? No, Wallace says, the riddle was something else. What animal is black, has six legs, and flies? A fly. In 1943, Jean-Paul Sartre published a famous drama called The Flies. It was a version of the Furies, the ancient Greek myth about the harpies that drive us and make our lives terrible. It was published under the German occupation in World War II, and savvy French audiences were able to see that The Flies was a critique of the Nazis, that the forces that were driving the lives of the French were nothing but numerous, though powerful, insects making garbage out of everything they touched. This subversive play, The Flies, plugs into the myth of the Oresteia, the only complete myth cycle that we have from Greek drama. Robrier is saying to us, there are other myths we could have used, but in this book, the myth is the Oedipus myth. Once we recognize this myth, we discover that all of the details in this book that look to be random and irrelevant actually cohere. They are parts of that larger story. For example, Wallace is given instructions to take a bus to go to a particular place where he's going to do some investigation. The bus line is Route 6. which he is told he should use until he gets to the place where it crosses Route 4. So remember to go to where 6 crosses 4. 6X4, 24. When Wallace begins investigating, his watch stops at a certain moment. When he accidentally kills the man who may be the man whose murder he was intending to solve, his watch starts up again exactly 24 hours later. The one day, the 24, is, as we're told of that bullet, something that comes out of myth. As Wallace walks up the stairs in Dupont's house, he notices that there are draperies over the windows. The draperies are net, and they have a pattern in them. Pattern that shows a column blasted by, an ancient Greek column, blasted by lightning, at the base of which is an infant and a shepherd. And next to that is another column and another infant and another shepherd. In other words, now that we realize that the story of Oedipus is crucial here, what Robrier is showing us is that Wallace is seeing a clear sign that the story of Oedipus, the staked-out child whose royal heritage has been destroyed by the gods, is going to be doubled. What happened in the ancient world still happens here. Freud, in The Uncanny, said that the uncanny is produced by seeing the familiar in an unfamiliar place. If you're on a trip to a different country, walk into a store and suddenly see someone from back home, it feels uncanny. If we take the metaphoric and make it literal, we get the uncanny. For instance, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. If I then sat down and began to eat a horse, your eyes would bulge. That's uncanny. This is an example of Freud's way of looking at the fantastic. In this book, Wallace keeps trying to get away from where he is, from his residence in the saloon, in order to explore the city, and keeps coming back to the same piece of dead canal. He asks, "Don't I know this city?" And realizes that, yes, he does. In fact, he'd been there once before. In fact, perhaps as a child with his mother. In fact, perhaps as an infant. The canny reader then realizes that this dead canal is a version of the birth canal, that Wallace is here in his own birth city, the one that he has never seen because he's been away from it since his infancy. The owner of the stationery store that keeps attracting him is a woman named Evelyn, with a carnal, throaty laugh, we're told repeatedly. And he finds himself drawn to her. Uncannily, he keeps going back to this stationery store, asking for an eraser, the kind that artists use. Outside the stationery store, there's a picture of Thebes. The store itself is on the corner of the Rue de Corinthe, the street of Corinth. And this picture of Thebes has before it an artist's model, a little wire and wood model, in a little toy smock, painting the picture of Thebes. But the picture of Thebes is actually oil, and the painting, supposed painting, is a photograph. Everything here is mirrors and reversals. The canny reader finds this. Wallace wants a special eraser. "What kind of eraser, Evelyn?" maybe his mother says. "The manufacturer's brand was printed on one side, but it was too worn to be legible anymore. Only two of the middle letters were still there. D-I. There must have been at least two letters before, and perhaps two or three letters after. In Greek, O-E-D-I-P-U-S. Oedipus. In French, O-E-D-I-P-E. Oedipe. It has two letters before and two or three after." If we read this book the way we read it at first, It is a fantastic inversion of the detective story, and it drives genre development forward. But if we read it again and find at the very center of the novel, that passage that I just read is exactly halfway through the book, we realize what Wallace never did. The thing that controls him is the inexorable power of myth in our lives. And the only way to get rid of myth is to give it its true name. To find that it is Oedipal, that it is someone else's story, not inevitably Oedipus's. We could have had Orestes' story, and that will allow us to erase it. It is not the erasure of simple recognition of trauma that Freud suggests. It is, in fact, a way of overcoming the language that has imposed a reality on us. In a book called For a New Novel, Robe Grier explains why he uses this bizarre cinematic style. He says, if we can go for the surface and get rid of the language imposed upon us, this use of our imagination to counter others' imagination is nothing less, he says, than to lay claim to freedom. For the canny reader, this is imagination leading to infinite possibilities.